concealing her movements. And the new haircut meant it would be difficult, if not impossible, to locate a photograph that accurately reflected what Sarah looked like now, which, in Garda speak, was actively taking steps to disguise her appearance. "No," I said. "Sarah wouldn't do this to us. She just wouldn't do it. I know her. She wouldn't leave us feeling like this." "You told me yourself, Adam. She saw the WhatsApp message. It was marked as red. Presumably, she saw all the messages you've been sending her. Potentially read the emails and listened to the voicemails as well. She got them all, and she chose not to respond to any of them." "There has to be a reason for that," I said. "Maybe she can't respond." "But she can go on a cruise?" I didn't answer that. "We've contacted the Department of Foreign Affairs," Cusack said, "and we will send a bulletin to Interpol tomorrow morning. But that's all we can do in this situation. That's all we should do, based on our review of it. And that's a positive thing." "You keep saying that," Maureen said, "but I still don't know where my daughter is." "What are we supposed to do?" I asked. "Are you seriously leaving us with Facebook?" "Actually," Cusack cleared her throat, "you might want to consider what may happen if you continue to appeal to the public, especially online, for help in contacting Sarah. People will find out about her last known location, and you know how quickly the tide can turn. You'll hear cruise ship, you think holiday." "Holiday?" Maureen gasped. "Holiday?" Jack shifted in his seat. "What about the passport?" I asked. "If she's on holiday, how's she going to get home without it? And who sent it? The writing on the envelope wasn't hers." Cusack picked up the passport again, opened it to a middle page, and turned it around so I could see what was stuck to it. An airline luggage sticker, the kind used to trace a suitcase that's gone missing. "This luggage tag has cork on it," she said. "If someone found this after Sarah lost it, they could easily use social media to track down the Sarah O'Connell who looks like the photo in it and who lives in Douglas, Cork." "Oh, right, of course," I said, "and figure out her address. How, exactly?"
"She's in the phone book."
"The phone book? How? I didn't even know they still made those." "It's just a checkbox whenever you get a landline installed," Cusack explained. "Did Sarah set up your phone or broadband account by any chance?" I nodded. "Sarah set up everything because more often than not, she was the one paying for it." "Well, there you go. There must be hundreds of other Sarah O'Connells living in..." "Her Facebook page is set to public, and she's checked in at your apartment complex in the past. It wouldn't take a detective to figure it out." "Just as well," Maureen muttered. I ran a hand through my hair in frustration. I thought about the last time we'd been in this room, all of us sitting in exactly the same positions, only with photos of Sarah fanned out on the tabletop between us. "What about the note?" I asked. "How does that fit in if the passport is returned lost property?" "Block capitals. Non-distinct. Signed with an initial. It could be..."
"It's her writing. I know it is."
"I know you believe..."
"It's hers!" I said, hitting the table with my hand. "I'm sure!"
"Fine," Cusack said. "Let's pretend for a second that the note is from Sarah, and that the passport is too, even though I can't think why she'd post her own passport home ahead of her. Whenever we do launch a missing person investigation, we have one of two goals. If we believe something has happened to the missing individual, we want to find out what that was. If someone else was responsible for it, we want to apprehend them. If we think the individual has left of their own accord,
then our end goal is to make contact. Contact is always what we're after, either directly between us and them or between the missing person and their family. Her eyes flicked to the passport.
No, I said.
No.
If this is from Sarah, Cusack said, then that's what it is. Contact. I don't believe it is, though. I believe this is, to use your words, returned lost property.
But we still don't know where Sarah is, or how she is, if she's okay.
You have no right to know. I realize that's tough to hear and probably impossible to accept, for now anyway, but Sarah is a grown woman. This may not be the nicest thing to do, yes, but she's perfectly within her rights to do it.
Don't you get it? Now my voice was rising. You're talking about someone I don't know. A stranger. An alien. I don't recognize Sarah in any of the things you say. She wouldn't do this. She couldn't do this.
But she has. I turned in surprise toward the voice that said this. Jack was looking at Cusack, pushing his chair back from the table.
We understand, he said to her. Thank you for your time.
He stood up to go and motioned for Maureen to do the same. She looked helplessly from him to me to Cusack, then back to Jack again.
But Sarah, she said to him.
Come on, Moore. Let's go.
I stood up too.
Jack, what are you doing? We have to find her.
How do you think we feel? He spat at me, having to tell everyone that our 29-year-old daughter ran away.
Putting her mother through all this, not to mention what she was up to before she flew off to Spain for herself. Spain and France. Wake up, would you, son? The girl is on holiday. Jesus Christ, it's like the bloody Peru 2 all over again. I don't want to know where she is or what she's doing. I don't care. This embarrassment stops now.
The so-called Peru 2 were a pair of young women who had been reported missing from the island of Ibiza a year or so before. The family of one of the women had launched an appeal for information, which spread from Facebook to mainstream media outlets. Her face was everywhere alongside pleas from her loved ones, who said she would never go a week without calling home. And Gardaí, meanwhile, were conspicuously absent. Then, a week after the story broke, the Department of Foreign Affairs found their missing person imprisoned in a Peruvian jail, charged with smuggling something in the region of 1.5 million euros worth of Class A drugs into the country, hidden in packets of food. The appeal and the girl's family instantly became the butt of internet jokes.
She doesn't deserve us looking for her, Jack said. She doesn't deserve us at all. Now come on, Moore.
Maureen stood up, her eyes on the floor.
Thanks again, Jack said to Cusack. Sorry for wasting your time.
He took Maureen's arm and together they started out of the room. Cusack looked to me. I know this is difficult. I didn't wait to hear the rest. I walked out too. Around 7:30 Tuesday morning, I heard the telltale clunk of the front door being pulled outward by someone entering the corridor from the stairwell. I was already standing in my hallway, waiting, ready to go. The car keys jingled in my hand. I would shout, "Road trip," Rose said when I opened the door, but it seems inappropriate. She was holding two takeaway coffees and handed me one. "You ready to go?" I had come straight home from Anglesey Street on Sunday and, after telling my parents of the conversation with Cusack, convinced them that I needed some time to myself. My father literally had to push my mother out the door, but they eventually left. I went straight to work, trying to get someone in Blue Wave to talk to me about Sarah. I needed to know when and where she had gotten off the ship. Well, first I needed them to confirm that she had been on the ship in the first place, and then I needed to know when and where she got off. I had never been on a cruise. Did you have to wait until the end, or could you get off before that? What about the days when they stopped places? Could Sarah have gotten off and stayed off then? Would there be a way to tell? What about the American? Had he been on the cruise too? Was he home already? Had they shared a cabin? When was any of this going to start making sense? I had spent the rest of that afternoon and most of Monday calling every telephone number I could find on Blue Wave's website, sending tweets to their corporate Twitter account, and even live chatting online with something called a customer experience ambassador. A futile experience. I felt I was either interacting with someone who couldn't stray an inch from a limited script of prepared responses, or merely generating automated answers based on keywords in the questions I had asked. Time and time again, I had been told that passenger information was confidential. Under no circumstances could they give out a single detail. I was getting nowhere until, just before 8 last night, an exasperated call centre employee, who must have been nearing the end of her shift, told me to put my request for information in writing. She even gave me an address to send it to. Blue Wave, it turned out, had its European headquarters in a business park 2.5 hours' drive up the motorway on the outskirts of Dublin. Wouldn't it be harder to dismiss me in person? I had been debating whether to go when Rose and Morsi knocked on the door, having come straight from work and bearing Chinese takeaway. Morsi had already filled Rose in on what happened at the meeting with Cusack. I had asked her what she thought. About Jack having a tin can for a heart? About Sarah being on a cruise? Well, Rose pushed a clean plate toward me and started pulling cartons out of a grease-stained brown paper bag. In all the time I've known her, Sarah never even mentioned such a thing. I mean, Sarah on a cruise? Stuck in an enclosed space full of retirees watching cabaret shows put on by X Factor rejects and stuffing herself at all-night high-calorie buffets. Does that sound like something she'd be into? Rose shook her head. Not the Sarah I know. That's just it, though, isn't it? I said. Who is the Sarah we know? I think, Morsi said through a mouthful of chicken curry, it's safe to say she was on the ship. The flight to Barcelona, the one-night stay in the hotel, the logo on the note, and Mary Marr's story, it all fits. It would be too big a coincidence otherwise. Yeah, Rose said, but what was she doing on that cruise? She was with him, I said. The American. I think we can assume that much. But then, for some reason, they went their separate ways. After the cruise. If we knew where Sarah got off the ship, we'd know where they separated. We'd know when. But Blue Wave won't tell me anything. They keep transferring me around and saying passenger information is confidential. So what are you going to do? Morsi asked. Well, their European headquarters are in City West. Where's that? Business Park, just outside Dublin. Rose raised her eyebrows. You're thinking of going there?
Thinking about it, yeah.
I'll come with you, she said. We can go tomorrow. I'll take a day off work. It was just as well that she did. Otherwise, I would never have found their offices. City West was a sprawling, well-manicured maze of nondescript glass blocks, busy signage, and serial roundabouts. We got there just before 10 on Tuesday morning and drove around in circles until Rose happened to spot a tiny brass nameplate affixed to the front of an office building.
There, she said. Didn't that say something about Blue Wave?
Stopping, I reversed a few feet. Blue Wave Tours, I read aloud, peering at the lettering. Your friends at sea. Afraid we might never find it again, we abandoned the car in the nearest empty space, Blue Wave's employee parking lot. Just before we headed inside, I checked my phone for new messages. That would be amazing timing, Rose said, watching me. Wouldn't it?
If she called right now and said, "Hey, what's up? Oh, sorry, I meant Tuesday. I'm at the airport right now. Come pick me up." I said, "Yeah," only because it was easier than admitting just how far past misunderstandings we now were. The lobby was a mess. Bare concrete floor was exposed, presumably awaiting the plastic-wrapped roll of carpet leaning against the wall in one corner. Framed pictures of the company's fleet of cruise ships were stacked on the floor. They all looked the same to me. Enormous, top-heavy, unlikely to float. All the lobby's furniture, a reception desk, a blue coffee table, six chairs with scratchy blue upholstery, were pushed to one side and covered in a fine layer of grey dust. The only sound was a radio talk show playing at low volume from an unseen speaker. The receptionist looked surprised to have someone to receive. She smiled and apologized for the mess. They were in the process of rebranding, she explained. "This is a corporate office," she said. "If you're interested in travelling with us, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. I can give you a number to call, though." She reached for a neat stack of business cards atop the reception desk. "My girlfriend is missing," I said. "The last place we know she was, for sure, was on one of your ships last week. Is there someone we can talk to about that?" The receptionist's mouth fell open. "Let me just make a call," she said, recovering quickly. "Please, take a seat." We sat. The receptionist, Katie, according to her name tag, left us waiting for more than 15 minutes. When she returned, she took our names and a few details about Sarah and the cruise we thought she had been on. Then she disappeared for another half hour. When she came back a second time, she asked if we happened to have Sarah's passport number. I was still carrying the Ziploc bag with the passport and note around with me, so I pulled it out of my jacket pocket. Katie seemed thrown by this at first, but then carefully copied down the number. After that, she plied us with cups of coffee and left us waiting once again, this time for over an hour. Eventually, a woman named Louise arrived to escort us elsewhere. No last name, no job title. She wasn't wearing a name tag. She was pretty, with big eyes and brown hair twisted back into a tight, perfect bun, but she looked skinny in that hard, sharp-angled way. A little older than we were, maybe mid to late 30s. Her heels clacked loudly on the bare concrete as she walked toward us. She greeted us both with sympathetic smiles, but they seemed to stay on her lips and keep well away from her eyes. "Sorry about the mess," she said, extending a hand to me. "We are just rebranding," I finished. "Yeah, we know." She led us deeper into the building, down a long grey corridor. It was just as quiet. I heard no sound but our footsteps and occasional traffic noise from outside. Louise directed us into a meeting room where more coffee, along with sparkling water and a plate of muffins, had already been laid out. This felt like the case of the escalating snacks. Louise motioned to two seats on the far side of the large polished table in the room's centre and then slid into a chair across from us. A thin manila folder, closed, was waiting on the tabletop in front of her. "I'm so sorry to have kept you waiting," she said. "We don't mind," Rose said. "We just hope you can help us." Louise flashed another cosmetic smile. "I hope so too." I caught a blur of colour in my peripheral vision. A fourth person had entered the room, an older man in a suit. Without a word, he walked past us to the far end of the table, took a seat there, and hoisted a briefcase onto his lap so he could take various things out of it. A yellow legal pad, a tablet computer, a tape recorder. "That's just Simon," Louise said, waving a hand dismissively. "You'll have some coffee?" Before we could respond, she started pouring. Simon got no further explanation, and as far as I could tell, he wasn't even going to acknowledge that Rose and I existed. It was odd, yes, but then so was this whole situation. I was getting used to odd. Odd was the new normal.
A mute suit recording our conversation with Blue Wave? Not the weirdest thing that had happened to me. Not even the weirdest thing that had happened to me that week. Now, Louise said when we had all been furnished with yet more caffeine and Silent Simon had pressed a button on his little digital voice recorder. Sarah. According to the Celebrates Manifest, we had a Sarah O'Connell on our 3-night, 4-day Mediterranean Dreams cruise departing Barcelona on August 11th last. The passport number that was scanned into our system at embarkation appears to match the passport number you've provided. On this itinerary, the newest member of the Blue Wave fleet, the Celebrate, carries up to 2,000 passengers from Barcelona, Spain, to La Spezia, Italy, and back again, stopping off for a day on the French Riviera en route. Sarah stayed in a junior suite with a balcony, close to the Celebrate's boardwalk promenade. It's an indoor space beneath a stunning atrium ceiling that lets you bask in sunshine during the day, watch the sunset turn the sky pink in the evening, and admire the glittering stars at night. Rose and I exchanged a glance. Was she trying to sell us tickets? Louise lifted the top item from her folder, an 8x10 colour photograph. When she held it up in front of us, my breath caught. It was Sarah. Posing in front of a painted mural, a cartoonish under-the-sea tableau, she was smiling. Laughing, actually, and wearing a blue dress I didn't recognise. It was the first I had seen of her since I watched her walk through the terminal doors at Cork Airport 10 days ago. The first proof that her life had gone happily on without me. That it was going on even while I checked my phone so frequently it was becoming a nervous tick. I didn't know what to make of it. I was confused about why she had gone on the ship. Sure, it hurt to think of her enjoying herself while I worried at home, but mostly I was just happy to see her face. I spoke to the Celebrate's cruise director on your behalf, Louise said, and he was kind enough to email me this. She tapped the photograph. It was taken on the first evening of the cruise, Monday the 11th, outside the Pavilion restaurant, by one of our professional photographers. We thought you might like to have a copy. She slid the photograph across the tabletop to us. Rose reached across me to pick it up. She studied it. She's on her own, she said after a beat. Yes, Louise agreed. Are you familiar with cruise cards? We were not. Passengers don't use cash or credit cards aboard Blue Wave ships, Louise explained. Instead, they preload cash or tie their credit card to a system we call Swipe Out. It's essentially a charge card they use on board for all purchases, and it's also an electronic key that opens their cabin doors. This also helps us maintain safety and security. Passengers have their identification information stored electronically in their Swipe Out, and it's checked against our system whenever they embark or disembark. This way, unauthorized persons cannot board the ship, and we have a continually updated manifest. There was just a single sheet of white paper in the manila folder now. Louise glanced down at it as she continued. I have obtained for you a copy of Sarah's swipe-out activity from the purser, as logged in our system beginning August 11th last. It shows that Sarah entered her cabin for the last time at 10:42 p.m. on the Monday evening, departure day, and then disembarked at 7:36 a.m. the following morning, while the Celebrate was tendered at Villefranche-sur-Mer. Where is... I'd forgotten it already. That place? The Côte d'Azur, Louise said. Villefranche is just a few minutes down the road from Nice. Nice, where the passport had been posted. What does tendered mean? Rose asked. If there isn't a suitable port to dock at, we drop anchor offshore and ferry passengers to and from the coast in smaller vessels, tenders instead. Nice is a popular stop, but its port isn't suitable for our ships, so we stop in Villefranche, which has the space in its bay and the onshore facilities needed to receive our tenders. We bus our passengers into Nice, or they can explore the coast by train or private tour instead. Sarah, however, left the Celebrate at Villefranche, and according to this, she passed the printout to me. She did not return to the ship. I looked at Rose, then back at Louise. Meaning? Meaning she didn't return to the ship. Was she supposed to? I'm afraid I don't have that information. We've been unable to access Sarah's booking detail. Which means what? Rose asked. In English. Louise flashed a brief, oddly pleasant smile. It means that for some reason I can't bring up Sarah's reservation on our system. There's no booking under her name. She waved a hand. It's probably just a glitch. But you were able to check the manifest, Rose said, and find Sarah's swipe-out account. Those are stored on different systems. But we need the booking information. I would stress that Blue Wave is not obliged to provide any information about our passengers. We have furnished you with the data from the manifest and the swipe-out account as a gesture of goodwill. We are going above and beyond already in providing you with that. Why are you providing us with it? Rose said. If passenger information is so confidential. What Rose means, I said, shooting her a look, is thank you. We really appreciate this. What about luggage? Did Sarah leave luggage behind? She only took one of those little cabin-approved trolley cases with her. Now Louise and Silent Simon exchanged a glance. I have no information about that, Louise said. But she could have brought that on the tender with her. It sounds small enough. The questions were stacking up in my head. I regretted not bringing something to take notes with. There were so many details we needed to know. When was the cruise booked? How was it booked? Online or with a travel agent? I suspect a travel agent because I had seen no payment to Blue Wave on Sarah's debit card. Did she put cash on her swipe-out card? If so, how much? Was that what the €650 were for? Was there any credit still on the card when she left the ship? Had she booked Blue Wave transport to Nice? Was there room for mistakes in the disembarkation identity checks? Was it definitely Sarah who got off at Villefranche? Was the reason they couldn't find her reservation because there wasn't one under her name, only his? Sarah, were you alone in that junior suite? I have so many questions, I said. I don't know where to begin. I understand. Louise pressed her lips into another odd smile. I do hope the information we've shared today has been of some assistance to you. At the end of the table, Silent Simon shifted in his chair. It was, I said, thanks, but we really need to know about Sarah's reservation. Like, was she travelling with someone else? Or, as I said, I was unable to access Sarah's booking detail. But could you? Rose asked. Like, if we waited a while. We don't mind waiting. Rose looked at me. No, I said. We don't mind. We can wait. I don't think that's possible, Louise said. I don't see us being able to recover that data anytime soon. Now, we have been very accommodating, but as I'm sure you understand, we have a commitment to our passengers and an obligation under the law to protect the data of the private individuals who choose to travel with us. Your situation is no doubt distressing and we want to help, but I'm afraid we have already helped all that we can. But I don't want any private information, I said. I just want to know when my girlfriend booked this cruise. There was a moment's silence. Silent Simon cleared his throat. It's a shame then, Louise said to the tabletop, that Sarah didn't tell you that. I felt as if I'd been slapped across the face so quickly and so suddenly that I wasn't even sure whether it had happened. The only evidence that anything had happened at all was the stinging pain. Rose, too, seemed stunned into silence. "I am truly very sorry that you are unable to contact Sarah," Louise said, lifting her eyes. "On behalf of Blue Wave and on a personal level. But we have no obligation here. We do wish you both well, and of course we all hope that Sarah will make contact with you sooner rather than later." Louise picked up the manila folder and pushed back her chair. "But we're talking about a missing person," I said. "Your ship is the last place we know Sarah was for sure. We need to know everything so we can find out where she went after that. It might lead us to where she is now." "According to the Gardaí," Louise said, "there is no missing person case. They told us they are attempting to make contact with her, but that the working assumption is that she left of her own accord." "Even if she did," Rose said, "we still need to find her. You're the only ones who can help." Louise stood up. A moment later, Silent Simon did too. "Who is this guy?" I said, pointing to our silent friend. "Is he your boss? What's he doing here? Does he talk?" "I'm sorry," Louise said. "This meeting is concluded." She turned to leave. "No," I said, "you can't do this. Don't you realize there is nowhere we can go from here? We have no idea where she went next. If you would just tell..." Louise stopped halfway to the door and turned. "Mr. Dunn," she said, "we're finished here. Katie will come in a moment to escort you out." She walked out of the room, followed by her silent friend. I turned to Rose. "Did that just happen?" She shook her head in disbelief. "What an absolute bitch." "What about that booking thing?"
"Bullshit," Rose said. "It's complete bullshit. Even if someone else made the reservation, her name would still be on it, right? It's like a flight. You can't just have a lead passenger. You have to give all the names. They must be hiding..."
Excuse me, a new voice said.
We turned to find Katie, the skittish receptionist, standing in the door, here to see us out. The walk back to the parking lot was a silent one. Once we were both in my car, I stuck the key in the ignition but didn't turn it on. "Rose," I said, "I just want to say thanks for coming with me. I really appreciate..." She was looking out the passenger window, clearly not listening to me. "Rose? Rose, I'm trying to say a nice thing here. Hello?
Hey, what are you..."
"Shh," she said.
"Shut up for a second."
"Rose, what the hell?
Look."
She pointed at something, and I leaned over to see. 5 or 6 parking spaces down and one row across sat what at first glance looked like a bus stop, but on closer inspection proved to be a smoking shelter for employees. Louise was inside, lighting up a cigarette and talking animatedly with an older woman. She carried herself very differently now. The way she was waving her arms about, the frequent drags on her cigarette, the quick shake of her head every few seconds. She had been so composed inside. Now she looked anything but.
"Turn the key so I can roll down the window," Rose said. "Then duck down."
"Why?"
"So we can listen, obviously."
I did what I was told. Rose cracked the window open a few inches and then reclined the passenger seat. At this angle, even if Louise turned to face us directly, she shouldn't be able to see us. Her voice, high-pitched and anxious, drifted into the car. She sounded like a different person.
"Before, didn't I? I told her I don't know how many times. It's not my job. I'm in PR. They called my degree Studies in Media Relations, and this is the third one I've done. The third. I had to do that Fiesta Boy. Yeah, that was me too."
"I know. Can you even..."
A truck rumbled past, drowning her out momentarily. "Had enough. I really have. No, I mean it this time. I can't do it anymore. Lying for a living. Like, what the fuck? Sorry, Marion. Excuse my French."
There was a pause, presumably while the older woman spoke in a much quieter tone.
"Yeah, I suppose. Talk to her.
Hate this place. There was a clatter of heels on tarmac as she and her friend walked away, back inside the building. We waited until we were sure she was gone, then sat back up. Rose turned to me.
So she did lie to us.
But why? I don't know. But I think a more important question is why she didn't only lie.
What do you mean?
If they don't want to give us the truth, why not just say they didn't find anything for Sarah? Why confirm she was on the ship and tell us about the time she went into and out of her room? They could have just said, no, sorry, no Sarah O'Connell here. It doesn't make any sense.
What about this does?
I lay back against the headrest and closed my eyes. Felt exhausted.
What do we do now?
You know, I don't really remember what life was like before I was just about answering that same question, over and over.
Sure you do. Rose buckled her seatbelt. And you didn't.
I turned to look at her.
Didn't what?
Answer the question.
We go home, I suppose. I started the engine. We just go home.
I dropped Rose back at Morsi's. He was at work. My parents were still adhering to my alone time wishes, although I figured I had only an hour or two before Mum finally succumbed to her maternal instincts and arrived back on my doorstep with a stack of neatly labelled Tupperware and a Tesco bag straining to hold boxes of breakfast cereal and packs of toilet paper. I wondered if maybe I should call Maureen, but I feared Jack would answer the phone. I wandered around the apartment, touching Sarah's things, picking up the odd item to examine it as if searching for clues.
Where is she?
I felt it then, buzzing faintly, starting to gather strength beneath my outward calm, seizing the opportunity that silent inaction gave it. Panic. Dinner. I would make some dinner. Yes, that's what I would do. I wasn't hungry, but it would involve a series of steps, foraging, deciding, preparing, consuming, cleaning, that would distract me for at least a half hour if I did it right. I was staring into the fridge when I remembered something we had overheard Louise say in the parking lot. I had to do that fiesta, boy. The fiesta. Could it be another blue wave ship? It sounded as though it could be. Who was the boy she'd been talking about? Another passenger? Did she mean she'd had to talk to his family too? About what? I shut the fridge and went to my desk. After a quick circuit of email, Twitter, Facebook, making sure Sarah hadn't been in touch since I checked 5 minutes ago, I typed the words blue and wave and fiesta into Google's search box and hit enter. The screen filled with results. There were nearly all links to official Blue Wave sites, special offers, explore the other members of the Blue Wave family, book your summer 2015 cruise now. I clicked on a piece from the Irish Independence website, written by the resident travel writer who had been invited to tour the fiesta before it launched, and then watched a 3-minute video tour of it on YouTube, filmed by what appeared to be a maniacally enthusiastic, over-caffeinated 20-something American blonde named Megan, who you may know as the cruiser behind the Megan's Muster Station channel on YouTube. What I saw in the video was as confusing as it was impressive. I knew that cruise ships were big, but I had no idea just how much they managed to fit on board. According to the video clip, the Fiesta had an indoor park with actual trees and a working carousel, a boardwalk promenade lined with old-fashioned arcades and strung with twinkling fairy lights, an enormous theatre, 3 cinemas, an ice rink, and a shopping mall, as well as hundreds of rooms, dozens of restaurants, and 5 or 6 open decks jam-packed with rows of blue sun loungers and swimming pools. And, as Megan either promised or threatened, depending on your point of view, much, much more. How the hell did these things float? I scrolled down and clicked through 3 pages of results, but saw nothing that could be related to the Fiesta boy Louise had mentioned. Next, I tried blue and wave and celebrate and got page after page of more of the same. The only difference was that the ads for the Celebrate always referred to it as the newest and biggest ship in Blue Wave's fleet. I went back to the first results page and clicked on a sponsored link that invited me to explore the Celebrate. I remembered that Louise had called the route Sarah took Mediterranean Dreams. The itinerary was listed at the top. I clicked on Show Me More. A new page opened, dedicated to that particular cruise. Barcelona to La Spezia with a stop at Nice. Translation, a mile off the coast of Villefranche in between. There were stats and dates and a map and passenger reviews. It was a long shot, but I started scanning them, scrolling down as I went, looking for any mention of a new friend the reviewer had made on board who could be Sarah, for her face in the background of a user-uploaded photo. Unsurprisingly, I found none, but around review 15 or 16, I came across this. Got a great deal on this cruise last minute, so decided to go despite what Chris D said on Cruise Confessions. So glad I did. I typed Cruise Confessions into the Google search box. It was a website that invited potential cruise ship passengers to get the lowdown on what it was really like to go on a cruise. Its homepage listed links to sections such as which cruise company is best and how to prepare for your first cruise and get tips from the insiders, staff and crew reveal all. And then, right at the end, deaths, disappearances and other cruise crimes. I clicked on the link and got a 404 error message. The page no longer existed. I went back to Google and typed cruise ship deaths, disappearances, crimes into the search box. Then I spent at least a full minute blinking at the results. Cruise ship deaths, index by year. Cruise crimes, search by cruise line or vessel. Foul play suspected in death of woman, 43, aboard Atlantic Dreams liner. Disappearance of teenager throws spotlight on epidemic of fatalities at sea. Search for French woman missing from oceanic escape called off. Murky maritime justice system failed us, says Scott family. Cruise company helped father's killer get away with murder, says grieving daughter. Cruise ship curse. Third woman plunges to her death. FBI to review honeymoon cruise death. Cruise FAQs. Staying safe on board. Latest fatality prompts concerns. Are cruise ships deadly? I felt sick, but also, for some reason I couldn't quite articulate yet, as though I was on to something. I scrolled back up to the top of the results and clicked on the first one. A list of suspicious deaths that had occurred or were suspected to have occurred on cruise ships. Christ, someone was collecting these things. The page had a short paragraph about each incident next to a photo of either the victim or the ship involved. Just two or three sentences about each one with a link to a relevant story if one was available. Not all of them, I soon realised, had links to news stories. In fact, most didn't. Did that have something to do with why I couldn't remember hearing anything about any of them? When the Costa Concordia sank, it had been the top story for a week and in the news for months afterward. Sarah and I had watched a bloody hour-long documentary about it, for God's sake. Why hadn't any of this been in the news? May 12, 2011. Female passenger discovered dead in her cabin after suspected fall, stroke, head trauma. Victim's sister receives anonymous tip that suggests death occurred elsewhere, possibly in staff quarters. Coroner returns verdict of accident. October 27, 2012. Female passenger becomes ill after drinking in casino bar. Crew member assists her with return to her cabin. Subsequently, subjects her to prolonged and violent sexual assault. FBI board at Port Canaveral, but crew member is not located. He continues to be sought by authorities. February 5, 2009.
Male passenger is reported missing, suspected overboard. A large streak of blood is photographed by another passenger on victim's balcony railing. Cleaning crews remove it before ship returns to port. Victim's friend charged with murder but found not guilty due to lack of physical evidence. Judge criticizes cruise ship operator for lack of cooperation. June 11, 2013. Male passenger is reported missing by family and search finds his body in lifeboat on Lido deck with stab wounds. Cruise company claims security camera pointed at lifeboat was out of order at the time. Case remains open. May 14, 2014. Adolescent male passenger, 16, falls overboard from pool deck after becoming inebriated. Cruise company admits unreasonable amount of alcohol was served to deceased's older brother, age 18, but deny liability. Civil action ongoing. Could a 16-year-old boy be Louise's Fiesta boy? I followed the news report link and found mention of the Fiesta in the very first line. It seemed that the older brother had been buying two drinks at a time for the evening, despite the barman's never seeing who the extras were for. Now the parents were suing Blue Wave for negligence. Both brothers had gone to one of the swimming pools afterward, and while they were there, the younger one went to the railing, perhaps to throw up or look over. He had fallen overboard, his body never recovered. An awful, tragic story, yes, but nothing to do with Sarah. The only connection seemed to be Louise, who presumably had had to talk to the boy's parents. I went back a page and continued reading. August 4, 2013. Female passenger is reported missing, initially presumed overboard. Cruise card activity subsequently shows that guest disembarked the ship at Nice, but her whereabouts remain unknown. Owners refuse to release security footage to corroborate disembarkation. Last update, January 2014, a civil action is ongoing. Accompanying it was a picture of the only cruise ship I knew well enough to recognize. The Celebrate. Underneath the photo was a link to a recent news story. I clicked on it. The internet couldn't tell me where Sarah was, but it only took 5 minutes to find me the man whose wife had disappeared after disembarking from the Celebrate almost exactly a year to the day before Sarah apparently did exactly the same thing in exactly the same place. It took only another minute after that to find me an email address for him. My hand shook as I typed a message to Peter Brazier. According to LinkedIn, he lived in London. According to his profile on a financial services firm's website, he was a portfolio manager. According to news reports, his missing wife was named Estelle. What to say? I introduced myself, briefly described the circumstances of Sarah's disappearance, and outlined what I was beginning to realize were horrifying similarities. August, the Celebrate, and Blue Wave saying she got off the ship in one piece. I mentioned my unproductive meeting with Louise and the Gardaí being no help at all. Finally, I signed off with my phone number and asked him to call me as soon as he could. Then I pushed my chair back from the desk so I could put my head between my knees. I had grown up in a loving, safe household in a nice, safe community. For most of my childhood, Mum left the doors open and Dad left the car unlocked. We lived in a country where, until the middle of the last century, murder was an annual occurrence, not a daily or weekly one. And when the murder rate began to catch up with the rest of the world in the 1970s, a terrorist group was the reason why. Crime, to me, was entertainment I saw on television. Evil was a Hollywood creation. Violence was what happened in foreign places 15 minutes into the 6-1 news. So-called because, here in Ireland, the evening news started a minute late so the bells of the Angelus could be played on national TV. Bad stuff happened to other people in other places, all of them far, far away from here. I didn't know where Sarah was, but I had assumed that whatever she was doing, she was physically okay. She had told everyone lies. She had cut her hair.
She had checked her WhatsApp messages long after she stopped answering her phone. She had done this, whatever this was. But what if, while she was doing this, something else had happened to her? What if she hadn't walked off the Celebrate? What if she had slipped or fallen or been pushed off? What if the Celebrate wasn't a clue to where she was now, but the reason for her disappearance? What if the same thing that happened to this Estelle Brazier woman a year ago had happened to Sarah too? The room suddenly felt airless. I stumbled out onto the balcony, gripped the railing, and gulped down the deepest breaths I could. Where is she? Then an onslaught of leaks from behind the wall that Denial built. What happened to her? Is she alive? Did it hurt? I'd been dumbfounded at Cusack's calm interpretation of events. No, misinterpretation. But what if I had been doing the same thing? Despite all the lies, despite all the confusion, there was one fact that we could all agree on. None of us had seen or heard from Sarah in more than a week. I thought of the angry voicemail I had left her, and my cheeks flushed with shame. I should have raised the alarm sooner. I should have known something was seriously wrong. I should have fought harder to get the Gardaí to do something. But the passport and the note inside it, those block capitals were definitely hers. Unlike Cusack, I had no doubt. I wasn't a handwriting expert, but I had been looking at them, on notes on the fridge, in greeting cards, on shopping lists, for the best part of a decade. Sarah had written that note. And then what? Decided she wanted the adventure of being abroad without travel documents? And the American, how did he fit in? What if he had done something to her? We didn't know who he was or what he looked like. Was that just because Sarah had been keeping him a secret? Or was that him covering his tracks? My phone rang. The screen read, Dan Goldberg. Oh, fuck off, Dan, I said, hitting reject. A few seconds later, it rang again. I didn't recognize the number, but the country code was 0044, a UK number. I hit accept. Hello? I said uncertainly. Is this Adam? A British accent. Yes, I said. Is this Peter? It was. He sounded older than I and, for want of a better word, posh. I pictured him working in the city and driving a small but flashy sports car. He sounded anxious, his words coming fast at times and then slow, breaths taking irregularly and in mid-sentence. I imagine it was what I would sound like if, in a year, I was still wondering where Sarah was. Then I tried very hard not to imagine that. Before my email to him, Peter had heard nothing about Sarah. His first question was whether the authorities were involved. Not really, I said. They seem confident that she left of her own accord and, well, she did. Most likely. But since I read about your wife, I'm not so sure about the coming back bit. Have they spoken to Blue Wave? No, I went by myself. And they confirmed she was on the ship. They have a Sarah O'Connell whose passport number matches. And they showed me a photo, and before all that, there was the Blue Wave logo on the note. The silence on the line was so long and so absolute that I pulled the phone from my ear to check that we were still connected. Peter? Are you there? When his voice finally came down the line, it sounded small and far away. He just said one word. Note. There's a note. It was sent here to our home, stuck inside Sarah's passport, Peter finished. Yeah. How did you... Did it have a postmark? Yeah. Nice? Yes. More silence. Peter?
Peter, how did you know that?
The note, he said, the words sounding as if they'd had to force their way around a choking constriction of his throat.
Are you sure it's in Sarah's writing?
Positive, although it wasn't her handwriting on the envelope. When Peter spoke again, the words came tumbling out. Estelle disappeared at the start of August last year. By Christmas, everyone was telling me I needed to move on with my life. We'd done everything. Gone to Scotland Yard, done the media rounds, made posters, gone to France. I'd even instructed my solicitor to start proceedings against Blue Wave to force them to release the CCTV footage of the tender platform that morning. My money was running out and I knew I needed to get the thing to trial, which is where it was going, because Blue Wave was refusing to even talk to us. So I went back to work, tried to get back into the swing of things. It was impossible. I would come to and realize I'd been sitting at my desk for an hour or more, staring into space. How could I concentrate on something as trivial as a share price when Estelle was out there somewhere, alone? Turns out I couldn't. I stayed another week before they put me on leave. Peter made a scoffing noise. But before I left, my secretary comes along with this archive box. Personal mail, she says. Turns out that ever since Estelle's story hit the papers, people had been sending cards and letters and prayers and things to the firm because, of course, they didn't have my home address. One day soon after, I was at home and, well, I was feeling pretty low. Real low. I started thinking about things. Things you shouldn't think about. A pause. A cough. But then I saw the archive box and I don't know why, I don't know what made me pick it up, but I started going through it. And right at the top, it must have been only the third or fourth thing I picked up, was a brown envelope addressed to me at the office, postmarked Nice. My view of the cityscape started to slide upward. I gripped the balcony railing with my free hand to steady myself. It was Estelle's passport, Peter said. My wife's passport, in perfect condition. I flicked through it and saw the note stuck inside. It was written on Blue Wave branded paper, a sticky note, the same kind of pads they leave in hotel rooms. What did it say? I pressed. What did it say? But I already knew. I'm sorry, Peter said. Signed, E. The soles of my running shoes smacked unapologetically across the stone floor of the atrium at Anglesey Street. The same cherub-faced Garda was standing behind the reception desk, but this time he was ignoring his tabloid newspaper. He was looking instead at the sweaty, panting, red-faced figure running toward him. His mouth began to open in question. Cusack, I said when I reached the desk. My lungs were burning. Coherent speech was a Herculean effort. Garda Cusack. Do you need... Garda Cherub looked me up and down. Assistance? Cusack, I said again, leaning against the counter while I tried to get my breath back. Garda Cherub leaned back from the other side. I need to speak to her. You can speak to me. I want to speak to her. What's it in relation to? She'll know. I'm afraid I have to know before I can... For fuck's sake! I roared, slamming a fist down on the countertop. Will you just fucking call her? The face grew less cherubic. His hand went to his belt where a little canister of something was hanging, along with what looked like a baton. Sir, you need to lower your voice. Immediately. Sorry, I just really need to speak to Garda Cusack, okay? She's the one we've been talking to. Is she here? Talking about what? My girlfriend. She's missing.
and I just got new information from this man, and his wife went missing, and he got a note too, and now I think maybe something awful has happened to her, and I need...
I ran out of breath. Garda Cherub slowly raised one eyebrow.
Sarah, I panted. Sarah O'Connell, that's her name.
I pointed at the computer sitting on Garda Cherub's side of the desk.
Look it up.
He did, while watching me out of the corner of his eye. He then directed me to a nearby row of chairs and told me to wait there. I collapsed into the first one and let my head drop between my knees. Cusack appeared 5 minutes later, wearing jeans and a t-shirt. She sat down in the chair next to mine.
What's going on? She said.
I was just on my way home.
I think something bad has happened to Sarah.
Adam,
a sigh.
We've been...
No, I said. This is different. This is serious. Listen. I told her everything. About the visit to Blue Wave, Louise lying, what I'd found on Google about cruise ship crimes, and what Peter Brazier had said about Estelle. About how a woman with no connection to Sarah had also been on the Celebrate just before she disappeared. About how the man that woman loved had received her passport in the mail too, also postmarked in Nice. About how the note inside had said exactly the same thing, only with a different initial. About how, a year later, that woman still hadn't come home.
And you think what now, exactly? Cusack asked when I was done.
That someone is out there kidnapping cruise ship passengers after they post notes home.
Oh, Jesus Christ!
In my peripheral vision, I could see Garda Cherub's head snap up from his sports pages.
What the hell do you need? To believe that something is going on here, Cusack? What will it take? Seriously, tell me. Bloodstained clothes? Video footage? A dead body?
There's no need. I feel like I could come in here and tell you I came home to an apartment full of someone else's blood and you'd be like, well, maybe a butcher came round and mistook your living room for an abattoir.
I rolled my eyes.
I thought the police didn't believe in coincidences, but you seem to see them everywhere. You see nothing but coincidences. So tell me, what does someone have to say around here to convince you people that a crime has been committed? I'm actually asking. Save me a fucking trip next time.
Do you like flying? Cusack asked.
Do I? What?
I hate flying.
Well, that's just...
I threw up my hands.
That's fucking wonderful, that is. Tell me some more utterly irrelevant things I don't give a shit about.
You didn't swear at all when Jack and Maureen were with you. Did you know that?
Yeah, well, back then I thought you were going to help us.
I hate flying, Cusack said again. I'm terrified of it. Avoid it as much as I can. But sometimes you have to get on a plane, and in this job you might have to get in a helicopter from time to time, which is even worse. So I went on one of those fear of flying courses. One of the first things the instructor told us to do was to look at the faces of the flight attendants if we felt scared. Like, if there was turbulence or a strange noise. Because turbulence isn't a big deal, and the crew know that what sounds like the arse of the plane falling off is actually just the landing gear coming down. They know it's normal,